Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of October 30th, 2018. We are in the heat of midterm madness, if you haven't noticed. With a week until Election Day, we recap the final gubernatorial debate, the candidates' last impressions on voters, and talk about where they are on several important issues. And also, be sure to join us at Growler House in Greenville this Thursday, November 1st at 6 p.m. for our first live taping. We'll have pints, political discussion, trivia, and more just days before the election. And a little full disclosure here, Growler House is owned by ETV Commissioner Craig Kinley. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. But since this week's story is so huge, and we're in the thick of the campaign trail, we absorbed campaign trail into this week's discussion. Now, you can still listen to all sections of this podcast. Instead of listening to Brenda complain about how she was three numbers away from winning the Mega Millions. Weird flex, but okay, Brenda. Or while you walk your kids around the neighborhood while trick-or-treating, knowing full and well that when you get home and they go to sleep, you will be the ghoul in the house and steal all the candy. And now, quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the state newspaper reported that former state representative Jim Harrison was found guilty on two counts of misconduct in office and one count of perjury as part of the State House corruption probe. Harrison is the first state lawmaker to get a prison sentence as a result of an ongoing state grand jury investigation run by Special Prosecutor David Pasco. Three other lawmakers have pleaded guilty and gotten probation. Now, these misconduct charges centered around Harrison's secret and illegal acceptance of some $900,000 over 13 years from Richard Quinn and Associates consulting firm, a name our leaders are well aware of. Prosecutors charged that Harrison had basically sold his influence as a prominent lawmaker and chairman of the House Judiciary Committee to secretly help the Quinn firm's corporate clients get their bills passed in the legislature. Number two, boondoggle update. The Post and Courier reported that a South Carolina judge could soon overturn the controversial Baseload Review Act. That law puts thousands of SC&G customers on the hook for the failed VC Summer nuclear project. And the paper reported that the move could upend a high-stakes fight over who pays for one of the biggest financial fiascos in the state's history and could trigger a $2 billion refund to ratepayers. Number three, the state newspaper reported that Florence County Sheriff's Deputy Farah B. Turner has died. Turner was fighting for her life in a Florence hospital after being mortally wounded on October 3rd while attempting to serve a warrant on Seth David Hopkins. He's a suspect in a case involving criminal sexual conduct with a minor. Now, Turner was the second law enforcement officer to die from that shootout. Florence officer Terrence Caraway also died in the standoff against Hopkins' adopted father, Fred, who opened fire on law enforcement officials and left five other officers injured. And number four, since we don't have a campaign trail this week, I want to give you a little bit of a trail bite right here. The Post and Courier reported that South Carolina Senate Republican caucus will not be able to fund expensive ads slamming Democrat Dick Harpulian in the open state Senate race for the Richland County District. Harpulian and Republican Ben Dunn are battling for the seat vacated by former Senator John Corson. Now, the state Supreme Court ruled Friday that a lower court's temporary restraining order against the advertising could stand. Judge Casey Manning ruled that the legislative caucuses can only spend up to $5,000 on behalf of one of its candidates due to the state's ethics laws. And like all those campaign mailers in your mailbox, we're burying the lead. Republican Governor Henry McMaster and State Democratic Representative James Smith both survived their final gubernatorial debate last Thursday from Greenville in what was their last and final appeal to voters statewide. Now all that's left is the mad dash of campaigning to Election Day on November 6. The final debate did provide us with additional insight on the two men who are looking to be the next governor of the state, from issues surrounding their small businesses, what to do with additional budget dollars, medicinal marijuana, and whether casinos should come to the Palmetto State. As a Halloween treat for you leaders, we brought in the two people who asked the questions at the debate. The moderators, Andy Shane, who is the Post and Courier's Columbia Bureau Chief, and Charles Bierbauer, Dean Emeritus of the College of Information and Communications at the University of South Carolina. Now, however, it's my turn to ask the questions. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Charles' first time on the show. This is very exciting to have you here, sir.
Okay. Where do we go from there?
Hopefully uphill.
Well, if you haven't noticed, there's a chart behind, and they often on social media about how often you've been here. So to break in a new person is going to be significant.
Yes, this will be very exciting. We'll get you to sign it. We'll get you a star up there. Maybe we'll get another star. Who knows? A lot can happen. Well, we have a lot to talk about, so let's start off with the governor's debate. Andy, what did we see in that final relatively contentious debate? You wrote a story over this weekend about whether James Smith moved the needle. Did anyone move the needle in this final debate?
Sure. I thought the debate on Thursday in Greenville was a little more even. I think a lot of folks thought the first debate in Florence the week before was pretty much a James Smith show. I think Henry kind of this was just like the primary debates. It seemed to take him one or two debates to kind of get sort of in the groove, and he was a little more in the groove. We can debate back and forth about who, quote-unquote, won, but I would say it was pretty evenly matched in this one. And to a certain degree, the reason I wrote what I wrote, which was, you know, some people have taken as, I think he's going to lose. No, I just said he's got to be more – I think he needs something more bold. I think he needs something to really push the needle because you're telling voters to fire a sitting governor. And you have to give them a reason to fire a sitting governor. And I'm not quite sure at this point, based on what I'm seeing and who I'm talking to and some other things, that there's enough to do that. So he does have now at this point when you listen to this podcast 1 week to do that. I mean, and elections can change in a week, as we know. So I think if he can just find that message and find those folks who may not be as excited, as Charles noted, the folks in the upstate are not as excited about Henry as they may be another candidate. If he can find that niche and try to get it over that 50 plus one. Right, thank you. Yeah. It's Monday morning, and it's always good to have a colleague help you. But yeah, to 50 plus one to get him over there, he needs to do it because basically public polls and internal polls are not showing him in great shape at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And you said in the groove, you mean they felt a little bit more comfortable on stage, is what you're saying?
Well, I think Henry was a little more active this time. I think he had some things to come back at him with. I think at the same time, I still think James did come after the governor a little bit on some issues, including abortion in particular was one. I thought, you know, he said he thought it was reprehensible how he had been using state money to try to sue and stop funding to Planned Parenthood and also was threatening family planning services for the poor just to be able to stop money for Planned Parenthood. You know, this comes at the base and he has said those things, but they haven't been, I think, megaphoned. And that's what I'm talking about. Is it shouting at his base saying, if Henry McMaster is governor, this is what the world's going to look like. And if you want to avoid it, come on out. He's also, I don't think, really trumped it up a bit. You know, the idea being, this is Trump's guy.
Yeah.
If you're like me and you don't think Trump's the guy, again, James is your guy. You want to come out. It's just not been very loud. It's been very subtle.
And Andy was talking about that abortion discussion during the debate was actually a pretty big moment. There was a lot of big lines being delivered in that. It was a pretty passionate moment. And the audience was also pretty engaged as well. They were engaged also during the medicinal marijuana debate. A lot of people were grumbling over McMaster's response that more law enforcement has to weigh in, that the science is not entirely there. What were your takeaways? What were some of the big moments, in your opinion, what we saw?
Well, those are important ones. And when you talk to people around the state, they're extremely concerned. You can't be overly concerned about health care. Mm-hmm. It's such a central issue, just talking to people on the way in here this morning. What do they want to know from the candidates? Want to know about health care. Is it still going to be there in whatever form, whether it's Obamacare, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's their own personal health care, which most people don't think is ever adequate. They'd like to hear more specifics about that. As to the general tenor of the last debate between Representative Smith and Governor McMaster, Smith is the challenger. He is a Democratic challenger in this nominally red state facing a Republican incumbent. He has to be the aggressor. Governor McMaster has to defend. And that's largely the dynamic that you had there. Much more of Smith challenging McMaster, and then McMaster having to battle back with rebuttals. I think that's not surprising. The other thing that and the piece that stopped me almost in my tracks was when I asked the question about immigration,
sanctuary cities,
and what we should be concerned about. It sprang off a question about health care and nursing, and a long tradition across the country of importing nurses, mm-hmm. importing teachers. In South Carolina, there are school districts that are aggressively recruiting teachers from outside the country. We're dependent on outside people for farm labor, for the tourism industry,
and for
the high-tech industry. So this is not a state that should be locking up its borders in that regard. And so I asked the question about immigration, and Governor McMaster's response was, we've got too many out-of-state students. As I say, that kind of stopped me cold because I didn't think we were talking about internal migration of students who may come from Maryland or Ohio. It was an unexpected and unanticipated, unpredictable, mm-hmm. and really off-track response.
How important, when we look at these overall, I mean, we had those two big debates. We had debates in the primaries. How important are these for shaping people's opinions of these guys? How important is it to shaping the outcomes? Does it even make it that much of a difference? I mean, obviously, we like to think so because we put so much time into it, but are people already have their minds set up? And we saw some polls that show McMaster already ahead by, 20-some points. Andy, do people see a lot? Or is it just maybe a matter of not messing up on camera and just kind of going through?
I think it's the latter. I mean, it's basically what people remember in debates is fights and mistakes, mm-hmm. Or really quippy lines, you're no Jack Kennedy. I think for the most part, you try to hold serve and you try to, you try your best and hopefully people watch to at least for an hour, get to learn a little bit more of who you are and what your positions are and how you can answer questions on the fly. For the most part, I think unless there's that mistake or unless you say something that is just so surprising that it would change someone's say, oh, wait a minute, I thought they were for X and they're really not, that you're really much solidifying where people are at this mm-hmm. point or more than nothing.
There's a general sense that the people who watch debates on public television or public radio are already the interested people. Whether it reaches out directly through the debate to the undecideds among the population or the peripherally interested is probably less of a case for that. But there's also a ripple effect. We have the debate for an hour, and then the local news organizations, for that matter, the national news organizations. The debate up in Greenville was carried by C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. So you do have the possibility of what takes place there getting broader circulation than and just the audience that is viewing it at that particular moment. I sat down the other day and rewatched the debate because I see it from one perspective on stage, and I see it from a different perspective watching it. But the other point that I would make in that regard, and the one that I consider the most valuable, is it's the only place where you see the candidates face to face, eye to eye, chin to chin, maybe mano a mano.
Yeah.
We didn't quite get to that, but in a situation where what we are trying to do, what Andy and I are trying to do, and others yourself who have participated in these debates, is to shape a question that requires them to think on their feet mm-hmm. and not simply parrot a response that they've already rehearsed. And so you get questions like immigration, and the answer comes out-of-state students, and you say, that was an interesting moment. What was he doing? And you can say the same thing about James Smith or the others. How did they react in the moment when they had to deal with something? My whole approach on public officials is I know where they stand on most issues. I don't know what they'll do in a crisis.
Mm. Well, and again, you were saying the message. I mean, Matt James, how many times did he say, Henry, you represent the status quo, or you're doing things to try to keep the job instead of do the job right? I mean, that was – and what you're hearing is sort of their theming. And also Henry coming back saying, James, all you want to do is raise taxes. And they would repeat that several times.
Just drilling those messages home so that's what they remember the most of. Andy, going back again to your story this past weekend about, the attention that the Democratic race has gotten, it doesn't seem like it's anywhere near – and I talked to Jamie Lovegrove last week about about this, anywhere near what we're seeing in Florida and Georgia. Obviously, different dynamics at play there. This is a different state, different candidates in those states. Is there a reason why we're not getting as much attention, or is there anything that could have been done maybe to have provoked a little bit more excitement in this race, or is it pretty much a foregone conclusion not to?
You know, it's interesting. The Democratic Governors Association encouraged James to run. Joe Biden encouraged James to run. Where are they? I mean, Biden did come for a fundraiser and has also shot a video for him. But it's not like Joe is constantly on social media or coming more than once or doing other things to do it. The DGA, I don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't seen ads. And, you know, Henry's considered, quote unquote, vulnerable because he was not elected to it. He was promoted. And Henry is running in his seventh statewide race and isn't really beloved among, I would say, more conservative voters for various reasons. And he's also just, frankly, and I think he would agree with me, he's not exactly the most exciting candidate out there. He's not Nikki Haley, who's, you know.
But he's not entirely, I mean, he can still, I mean, he's a safe margin.
Yeah, he's a safe
they
margin.
Might, they
yeah,
might
safe
see
margin.
Him yeah, vulnerable, but.
Yeah.
And he hasn't made any egregious mistakes in his 2 years as governor.
And that's very fair.
But the Trump, I mean, I feel like, and we're going to wrap up right here, but I feel like with the tariffs, if we were a year out of this and we were still dealing with it, and we saw maybe some outflows from BMW, some farmers being pinched harder, some port volume going down affecting the port. I mean, we haven't really seen the entire ramifications of this entire trade war yet, and I think that probably could have perhaps framed this differently if this was to happen a year or two from now.
Those are things that take time before you do see the effects.
I mean, besides Element Electronics coming back. But.
And that's such a small piece. It's a nice little example to use to serve your own purpose. It didn't go away. It came back. But it is compared to the BMWs and the Volvos and the Mercedes and Boeing. It is not significant in terms of what would be the effect over the span of a year, 2 years, 5 years of the Trump tariffs.
And let me leave it with this, is that in the hyper-partisan political world we're in right now, first of all, South Carolina is a very fairly red state. We're usually in the top 10, top 12 of being leaning the most Republican in the country. And that no matter what, people, I think, are going to have a hard time who vote R to vote D, even over an issue like BMW and tariffs and their neighbor, the farmer who's getting hit. I think, you know, people feel like, you know, this is the guy and this is the party I'm with. And the other guys, I don't care how good they may make things or how whatever, I got to vote this way because no matter what, there's a game plan that's involved with the tariffs that I think are going to come through.
A lot of people are going to pull that straight ticket R lever or the D lever. That's another factor that in states that are polarized, in an environment that's as polarized, it's harder for them to cross over. And so the middle ground is always the battleground. And since we don't register as Republicans and Democrats in South Carolina, there's that shifting, somewhat amorphous, how many people are in the middle, how many might be disaffected Republicans who are really the never Trumpers, and those are the numbers we'll need to look at on November 7th.
Yeah. And we'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on the Lieutenant Governor's debate, which both of you are moderating again. I just wanted to start off by saying we are taping this podcast on Monday, hours before the first and only Lieutenant Governor's debate between Republican businesswoman Pamela Evatt and Democratic State Rep Mandy Powers-Norrell. So it's a bit weird. We're living in the past and the future. But Andy, what do you expect from this, and what do the candidates need to do at this debate?
I think they need to introduce themselves first of all. I think one of the things, and again, if you haven't seen it and you listen to the podcast, there will be links on YouTube and on SCE TV to watch the debate. Is for them to introduce themselves and talk about what roles they're going to have in the administration if their candidate wins. Mm-hmm. This is the first time we're having running mates with our governors. They used to be elected separately, in fact. So this is going to be a different role. This is going to be something that's novel, historic in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that both of these candidates are folks that maybe people don't know as well. So I think it's going to be introducing themselves and then talking about what they believe in.
Republican running mate for Henry McMaster's Pam Evatt, businesswoman from the upstate. And then James Smith's running mate is a fellow state representative, Mandy Powers-Norrell. Charles, what are you going to be looking for? Obviously, we're talking the future and the past here at the same time.
Well, the last question that we asked of Governor McMaster and Representative Smith at their debate was to tell us a little bit as to why they chose each of these women as their running mates and what they expected them to do. And Governor McMaster said of Pamela Evatt, well, she's a businesswoman. She brings a knowledge of the business world. She's not a tried professional politician who's been around for 30 years. So she's different in that regard, much more complementary to McMaster than what I think Mandy Powers Norell is to James Smith. His response was, we've worked together in the legislature. She understands the legislature. She can work effectively in helping propel legislation through the General Assembly, which is probably quite true. So in the one case, I see more complementary experience. In the other case, more parallel experience. I expect that they'll have to explain that. And as Andy points out, neither one of these women is well known outside of their immediate circle, although they've both been campaigning across the state.
Mm-hmm. Does that give Mandy the opportunity to be a little bit more specific on issues? And, you know, I mean, we're seeing that within the gubernatorial debate itself, where these two men have been in politics for decades. I mean, obviously, Mandy's been around for a while. Does that give her an advantage over Pam in a way, Andy?
I think one of the things is that at least on paper, it does. And again, speaking on Monday before the debate, you know, Mandy has been in the State House for 6 years now. She's a litigator. The thought is that she's obviously a little more prepared for this kind of atmosphere than, say, Pamela, who it's not sort of a natural thing for her to do, and this is her first time running for office, so this may be. But at the same time, she's an unknown, so it'll be interesting. That said, just to dovetail off of what Charles was saying about the differences between the tickets, one of the interesting things on the Democratic ticket is that James Smith and Mandy Powers Norell have really talk themselves up as a team, sort of a twofer, as it were. They're campaigning together constantly. Now, there's a reason why Pamela Evatt and the governor aren't campaigning together as much is because the governor has got to be the governor and has to do those things. And in fact, what Pamela gives him and gave him before in the primary and now is, of course, someone who can go out and campaign while he is doing official gubernatorial business. But it'll be interesting to see how that meshes together once maybe they get into office, if they win, versus James and Mandy, who know the system and know how it works and have been portraying themselves as a team since the announcement that she was going to be his running mate.
There's also a geographical element to these pairings that's probably worth noting. Pamela Evatt comes from the upstate, conservative stronghold for Republicans, a place where Henry McMaster struggled in the Republican primary because he had upstate opposition. And so I think that's probably a helpful element from his perspective to have her in that kind of a pattern. Mandy Powers Norell is from up in the Lancaster area, and Smith is, of course, from Columbia, and they've done a lot of their campaigning, as best I can judge, in the Lowcountry and in the upstate, where both of them are less well-known. James Smith may be the statewide candidate, but he's a representative from Richland County, and representatives tend to be known locally, not broadly across the state. Mm-hmm. So I think we're seeing some of that pattern in the way they've campaigned.
Well, a very informative discussion with Andy Shane with the Post and Courier and Charles Bierbauer, Dean Emeritus from USC. And join Charles and myself. We'll be live hosting on election night for 2 hours. You'll be having several guests.
I'll be at the Republican. We'll be in the studios here 8 o'clock on election night.
So we'll have a lot of fun to look over all the information as it comes in. Of course, we'll be doing a huge debate recap, and we'll also be doing a live taping this Thursday at Growler House in Greenville, November 1st at 6 p.m. We'll be doing some pre-election discussion with some pints of beer also, so that'd be nice and enjoyable. Again, thank you guys both for attending today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that Russ McKinney, South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney, that is back with some more state trivia. Let's see if I can keep my losing streak going. I've only gotten one right so far. Also, we'll have Russ at Growler House this Thursday, November 1st, Growler House in Greenville at 6 p.m. to do trivia during our live taping event at Growler House in Greenville, November 1st at 6 p.m. So, Russ, welcome back.
And thank you.
What do you got for us?
Well, we've got something kind of right down your alley today. We're talking about unique South Carolina cuisines.
Oh, I'm hungry already, Russ.
So there are
boiled peanuts. I called it. Okay.
There are a number of dishes that are unique to South Carolina and the South, but we're going to focus on those that actually originated in South Carolina and expressly unique to South Carolina.
Interesting.
So the question is which of these is not,
ooh,
or did not originate in South Carolina and may not be uniquely associated with South Carolina?
All right.
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. A, chicken bog. B, low country shrimp boil. C, pine bark stew. D, shrimp and grits.
Oh, come on, Russ. What did you think of this one? Like... No, I'm like originated. Like obviously, a lot of this has their a lot of these dishes have their
That's
roots
correct.
In other countries. Obviously, that were brought over and really made famous here. And they're obviously, but what's the hip phrase for Southern cuisine these days? What do you want to call it? The new South cuisine. So we have chicken bog, shrimp boil. Even though
low country shrimp.
You said low country because then there's also the frogmore stew. You know,
right? Beautiful stew. Yeah.
Pine bark
stew.
Yeah. Okay, that's the first. And what was the last one?
Shrimp and grits.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Come on.
We didn't even mention
We
didn't even mention she crab soup.
Yeah, because I'm still too busy laughing about pine bark stew. Now, if that is a thing, I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone, but I can't believe that is a...
So your answer is?
Pine bark stew. I'm just too blown away by it, so I'm going to...
Okay, so you're going with pine bark stew.
Yeah, we can hedge with shrimp and grits, but I'll do pine bark
stew.
Okay,
well, the answer is B, low country shrimp boil.
Yeah, okay. Well, you put low country in the name, you kind of throw it.
That is not, that you find that in other southern states. The
True.
Others, chicken bog, I'm sure you're familiar with that. That originated in the PD or the Carolina low country. Pine bark stew is a fish stew.
Okay.
And originated in the Williamsburg area. It's a gentleman from Kingstree, according to legend, is the person who created that stew. Shrimp and grits, of course, we find shrimp and grits throughout the South, but that particular dish is linked to Charleston cuisine.
Hmm. Okay, so if you're going to get any of those dishes, obviously get them in South Carolina, except your shrimp boil. Well, thanks, Russ. Now we know. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways South Carolina ETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org, listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio, and watch This Week in South Carolina, a public affairs show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search for us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @scledepod. That's at @scleadpod. And you can find our photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our sweet memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scleadpod. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. And then take a photo of it, send it back to us, and let us know where it ends up. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on October 29th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. All lead and no play makes Jack an informed boy.